I'm Judith Stoutland. Our session is Making Peace, Reducing Violence. And we have done some work in defining what peace is, knowing that it is a definition that is very broad. We've gone through some things of what it is not. And basically I would say, and if you want to add something more to this, we would say that peacemaking is active and involves many things. One of the things was to make peace within ourselves first, within our communities, whether they be family or intimate relationships, or whether our larger towns, congregations, then the nation and the world. Today we are going to focus our thoughts and share our experience and our questions about making peace, reducing violence, which is for many people what peace means, no violence. We're going to examine that and do some more talking and sharing about those things. So I'm going to begin by putting down some of the things that John Stoner, who wrote this book, which we've used in a number of ways in our discussions, a number of the things that he says we can do for reducing violence, actions that we can take. I'm going to put them on the board now as a way of drawing in all of the things that you want to talk about or to focus the interest of the group on simply one of them. We have an hour and this is going to, we can't do everything. So, maybe before I do that, I'll write this down as we do some of our talking so that you can focus on that. But first of all, what are some of the spheres in which, some of the areas where you see a need for reducing violence?
Family. TV.
Which is kind of a substitute family for a lot of people, isn't it?
Yeah.
Maybe you can see better there. All right. There's only one row here, is what we're trying to emphasize.
Yeah, it's okay. It's so-called like music. That's
okay. Sort of pop
music.
Popular music.
There's some operas of violence, so I guess we should.
Yeah.
Well, yes, but it seems to be.
All right.
Yeah, so, some of it, and they get into such, I'm talking about what I experienced in Seattle, these dance clubs that they have there.
Uh-huh. Okay, so there's violence in music and dance. Any other places?
Play.
Play.
Okay.
When people are violent in sports and
playing.
Playing.
Okay. Sports.
Even children's playing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Etc. Oh, this could also be not just music, dance. Do you see violence in any other arts?
Well, movies, theaters.
Yeah.
You know. We're not inclined to be an art, I guess, but. Movies, theater. What about visual arts?
Mm-hmm. Sports. Yes.
Because I bring this up because one of the ways in which people can make peace is in the arts. I mean, to use the arts for making peace as well. So if we recognize certainly that if the violence is there, then we can make the peace by counteracting it or using it that way. Any other spheres?
Funny papers and comic books and...
We could put this in, could we put this up sort of in contemporary communication?
I think books.
Okay. In one sense, that expands on just the arts.
Yeah.
And comic books of popular art such as TV as well. Books. I think we're going to go to another color here. See what blue does for us today. Books, comics.
Classroom relationships.
In the classroom.
Neighborhoods.
City streets.
Selling of guns.
Okay, Spears, well, yeah, so guns would make many Spears violent within the family on the city streets and out, and where else with guns?
International relations.
Okay, so we can go, here we've got our expanding circles, family, community, in our own nation, if that, we want to go that way, nation, and then international. Any other spheres that we want to talk about? Well, we need to make peace.
Politics.
Do you want to say any more about how that would be?
I think that in politics, that, oh, go ahead, excuse me.
Sorry, well, it, just the, much of politics is adversarial rather than cooperative. Mm-hmm. We can make some progress there.
Okay. Versus. Versus cooperative. Well, so you see, we've got a lot, a big area where we can focus on and things to cover. Reducing violence, as I said, we often think of violence as the opposite of peace. So if you're going to be a peacemaker, what you have to do is to get rid of violence. And the longest tradition of thinking of that involves, what would you say? Just typically, when people are saying they're a peacemaker or that they want peace, what sphere would they maybe focus on first of all, thinking that that's what it's all about?
Nuclear weapons or something.
Okay, the international, the national, the things that involve the biggest weapons. And so that's where we tend to think of the greatest need. With nuclear weapons, there indeed it was and continues to be certainly a very significant one because it has such power and such threat to us all on a major scale. So that threat is there. We don't always tend to think of the ways, although I think we're becoming much more aware of it in the United States today, of the ways in which we need to reduce violence, in particularly families. Do any of you know any statistics about the violence in families? I'm not good on remembering statistics, but the amount of violence.
One in four children are brought up in a violent home.
One in four. Well, that would be one in four children. That doesn't mean one in four homes are violent, right?
Well, that, yeah.
It could mean that, but it not necessarily. You could have more children, like three children, than one violent home. And since we know we learn what we live, that's going to say a lot about how much violence we're going to have in our society. And so we think of the violence here as being what kinds of violence?
Misuse of power.
Okay. Now, misuse of power, can also, that's a good focus to bring it to, and more specifically, how is that power misused? What power and how is it misused?
Control of those who are bigger and stronger. So it can be father against mother, father against children, mother against children, older siblings who then have learned this pattern against younger.
And it's both physical and psychological power.
Physical control, psychological control. What is the big nuclear weapon of psychological control? You would say, the thing that really is at the heart of a whole lot of violence, a whole lot of the unpeaceful things. What happens if somebody intimidates you? What's the consequence? The psychological, negative psychological power.
Loss of self-esteem.
Loss of choices.
Loss
What happens when you say, do this?
Alienation. Withdrawal. Anger.
Anger. All unhealthy things that we see. And probably most of all, fear underlying it all. And in our session yesterday, when we talked about centering a peacemaker, we talked about the importance of dealing with fear and acknowledging it so that it could be dealt with, recognizing where it came from and how to deal with it appropriately. I'm going to refer now and again to the people in the exhibit. Junie Nelson talks about fear in adults and its negative impact on children. She is the first person to the right in that lineup, and she is a child. She has a preschool child care center, and she talks very much about how she works with the children to develop healthy things. In this particular selection, I was not able to include what she says about the damage that happens to children. She and her husband John had three children born to them, and they adopted four more, and then they adopted four of the more than 20-some children that they had as foster children. And she speaks about how the pain of knowing that no matter how much love you give a child, after a certain point of damage, it hasn't worked. It hasn't brought that child back. It hasn't renewed and healed that child. In some cases it can, and in some cases it can't. So she speaks to the really deep damage that is done by that kind of fear and intimidation and the control, that negative control, and that negative use of power. So these are some of the things that are the consequences then of the violence that is there. Yeah.
I think one of the other things that goes right along with family, since it's sort of disintegrated, you don't have the consequences. I mean, you commit acts, but there are no consequences. And you're growing up without family. I think that this is really a problem right now. There are no consequences for your actions that you have to take responsibility for.
I'm not going to remember all of these, but these are some of the consequences. And then the further one is, no sense of consequences, which is a very important result. No sense of balance for leading your own life in a good sort of way, knowing what will happen.
Along with that, no sense of boundaries.
Okay.
No sense of where I begin and where another begins, and an honoring of that. Mm-hmm.
Read what Junie Nelson says about her way with children in the thing. She speaks of how...
I have. I grew up with her.
Wonderful.
Three doors down.
Right. Well, you could maybe tell us much more about it than is there. But she speaks of how she deals with two-year-olds, and she just loves children. And she said, you know, they're real sweethearts. She just loves them. But they're not perfect. And they have to learn where their boundaries are. They have to learn that they themselves are wonderful people, but they can't act exactly as they wish at all times. So they learn self-respect by learning respect for other children, other two-year-olds as well. Anything else you want to say about the spheres where we need to reduce violence?
Well, I was thinking about the playing, you know, and remembering the group games that I used to play all the time as a child. Mm-hmm. It seems it was always cops and robbers or cowboys and Indians, mm-hmm. and probably the phrase that most frequently escaped my lips was "bang bang, you're dead." You know, mm-hmm. and then we all have had these toy weapons and fascination, mm-hmm. with young boys in particular to have toy weapons, and I imagine that the lack of consequences in childhood play about that kind of use of violence may have an effect later on when people, mm-hmm. begin to use the real thing and to realize that relationships are often fighting or defeating or overpowering kind of game.
Annihilating.
Annihilating, yeah.
I don't watch a whole lot of TV, and I don't watch much more than the public station. But once in a while, I've seen a couple of programs, which I can't, probably don't even remember the correct names of, but it runs a sort of a city cop and cops and robbers in I think it's L.A. or San Francisco. And whenever, it's all set up so that they want to get somebody, and the amount of shooting that goes on for capturing somebody is fantastic. There's just so much violence. And the message I got was that if you want something to change, the way to do it is to shoot at it. And I think this is true. If it's true on our TV sets, I think it's, that's the impression I get in our international politics.
In our politics, somebody talks about setting a goal that we can shoot for. I mean, that is so fundamental.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right. And the language of all this is an important thing. We could sometime maybe just have a whole series on the language of peace, or the language of peace and justice, because our language is full of words that we use in ordinary ways that are very aggressive words.
We even hammer out an agreement.
Yeah. Well, yeah. For peace. Wage war for peace.
Yeah.
Wage peace. And I suppose if you say wage peace, I don't know, but we just have to watch ourselves on so many grounds. It's really complex.
I think that it's very striking because language is such a powerful effect of thought and behavior. It's not conscious, it just becomes a part of our lives. And I think we don't have good alternatives in conflict resolution. Mm-hmm. And so we keep using this language, and we are imprinting ourselves with the fact that the only way we can resolve conflict is with war. I mean, subtly, that's the alternatives.
So really,
issues of alternatives in conflict resolution seem so stuck in language.
That's right. So alternatives, we're talking really the importance of language. And alternatives in language, and if we can find alternatives in language, that can direct us to the fact that we need to have alternatives in the issues that we say. So we say, well, we have a situation, we say it either has to be this or that, it has to be either or, and the way of peace is often in the alternative that we can find between it. So the other word, one of the words we've used as our buzzwords or core words, focus words this week is continuum. So if we've got position A, let's call it, that'd be better, and position B, we think that's all we've got. It isn't that C has to be exactly smack in the middle. It might even be down a little bit. It might even be sort of a combination of something of that sort. But to look for alternatives, it's a really important thing, both linguistically and as a solution. Yeah.
Another angle of alternatives in drug education is we have to teach kids how to get high on life. And it can be art or any of these things. It can be literature. But they've got to feel good about something so they don't need a false sense of high. So maybe that's one of our reducing violence things. And I'm getting ahead of you here, but I believe.
Okay.
We've got to give people something better. And, of course, it can be a faith in God for most of us.
We have to be careful, too, though, with the not having the onward Christian soldiers.
Right. Yeah. That's right. It was William James who said we have to have an alternative to war, that something that was as exciting, that demanded as much commitment, that demanded as much intelligence and creativity and so forth as war does. I mean, people will say, look, all of our preparation for war has given us all a lot of things that we like. I mean, you've got, we've got small TVs, we've got great cameras, we've got sound systems and all sorts of technological things that come directly out of the research that was done for some of the, some of what we call our national defense. I put that in quotation marks. The satellite system, all of these things, that's, you know, it's doing you good. It's, you know, your tax dollars working for you. Well, that's sort of like you know, pacifying somebody, you know, giving them a piece of candy while you're taking away their whole meal. We need to focus, we need to say, look, we can do that without focusing on war, but we can do something that is as challenging, as exciting as the war can be, but that is healthy.
I think one of the other things that you need to look at is getting down there, and at least in politics and maybe in some of our own lives, is there something we're doing that is based on status quo? I mean, we want to keep things the way they are. Mm-hmm. The fact that there is violence, the fact that there are broken homes, gives some of us jobs. Mm-hmm. And it's our economic underpinning. We are a society. If suddenly violence went away, there's an awful lot of people that wouldn't be employed.
Okay. All right. So,
there's,
what? Close
okay. Military base, I have.
Okay, that's a big issue.
The other thing I'm just coming to realize is what a romantic thing war is, and what I mean, you're dealing with life and death, you're dealing with loss, you're dealing with passion. I mean, I'm suddenly realizing that war has always had that power of change, you know, of drama in people's lives. And what could you have that would be, you know, right. Replace that much power and drama and romance with?
Mm-hmm. You're exactly right. That's what we need. That's what we need to work for. We're coming back to this, I think. And you're talking about alternatives. It's of interest to me that we use this word, which is usually a theological term, conversion, but it means to turn, conversion, and we need that in our economics. Mm-hmm. You're talking, I mean, those of you from California said yes. I mean, my nephew lost his job because what he was doing was, he didn't realize it, he was doing, I think as closely, it wasn't so obvious, he was doing technical writing, and the projects were all supported by the Army or something, and he lost his job. And it's a part of what happens in the downsizing of various things. So economic conversion. In Minnesota, we've had task forces that have been looking at ways in which that military economy can be turned around, and that the same plants can be doing things that will be for peaceful means and for other things rather than for the military or those things associated with the military. I mean, talk about an uphill battle. It's worth it climbing the copper basin. I mean, it's just really. So in economics, and that means the let's call it war industry, and you were saying, okay, it also is in what we call public service industry for certain things. Anyone have a response to that, particularly now, let's say, to the public service?
If counselors are good, they will put themselves out of a job. People won't need them anymore.
What's another reality that we have?
Poverty?
No, I'm speaking more towards just this issue of the conversion. It's kind of like saying doctors will put themselves out of jobs, too.
They could all stay well.
But it probably is true that because life is complex and life is not perfect, there will be a need for people in these professions that help others with the difficulties that come up. Because it happens again and again. I'm a gardener. It's like weeding the garden. Those of you who take care of your lawns know that you don't mow your lawn at the beginning of the summer and say, that's it, got this great lawnmower, takes care of it all, don't need a lawnmower anymore. You know that certain things are going to be coming back again and again, but it would reduce perhaps the need for that.
Or it would help if you could focus on prevention and maintenance,
okay,
of support of the kind of things that lead to peace rather than mm-hmm. trying to correct. If you have a polluted stream and you keep trying to take out the impurities at the base, you go up and keep.
Look at the source.
The yeah. source and keep mm-hmm. tended and nurture, mm-hmm. so that you can focus that kind of support in a different uh-huh. direction.
Okay. So that these are things to keep in mind and to be very much aware of, because these kinds of things aren't going to happen automatically either. We're going to have to work for the kinds of And many of these things are so systemic, they're in the system so deeply that one company alone can't do it, although one company can start certain things. And so we need combined work, we need community on this, we need the unions to work towards it, we need to work towards it through legislation. And that can seem very slow, and it can seem very discouraging, but it can also lead to some good things. So it's an area where everyone can make their voice heard. And I think it's difficult to say, it's just one voice and it's a small voice, but I think, how many of you are in touch with your legislators? No. So they know you, probably, and know sometimes they're, you know, sometimes you can find that the legislator does remember you. You say it's just one voice, and say, "Oh yes, yes." They say, "In fact, my legislator thinks that every time I talk to him, I'm going to mention El Salvador." And he's really surprised. I enjoy talking to him about other things to let him know that that there are other things as well. But a voice can be a single voice can be heard. So that's important there. I'm sorry, we postponed your comment till
you. Well, if you're talking about alternatives and you're talking about violence, it seems to me poverty and all the injustice that goes with it is surely an enormous part of it. And then I started thinking, we had a prayer at Vespers 2 days ago talking about, I don't remember exactly what it was, but it in essence said, if you're going to correct injustice, there has to be some, they didn't say violence, but it was, violence was a part of it. That the tyrants don't willingly give up their power. So I'm wondering, is there a conflict between peace and justice?
Okay. Right. Let's write that down. Anyone want to talk about the word? This is terrible because we get started with a simple sentence. No, it's wonderful actually. It's what's terrible is the problem that you get a simple sentence and then you say, well, first we have to talk about this and this, and so you could spend an hour on this, just this. Is there a conflict between peace and justice? So we maybe need to understand what we mean by conflict.
Is it possible we have one without the other?
Yeah. All right. Are they completely in, this can range again in our continuum word from total incompatibility to an area of struggle and stress to, if you don't have one, you don't have the other. So
no peace, no justice.
No peace, no justice. Right. If you want peace, work for justice.
And it's this issue that's behind the just war theory, that mm-hmm. you know, some wars are justified because there's so much injustice that you have to go to war to correct that imbalance.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like internationally we're stuck on that thing with Bosnia. People are saying, well, we should be peaceful and not have war, and yet everyone's acknowledging the horrible atrocities that are taking place, and in some ways to not be involved in that violence seems that we're not doing our part as human beings. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's terrific conflict between them.
The issue is how to protect human beings in a nonviolent way to prevent more violence from happening to them. That is a real struggle. And the whole those people who live and are committed to nonviolence and work towards it have that struggle. And it
but the military systems that were set to preserve certain interests of those entities, whether it was NATO or whether it was the old Warsaw Pact or whether it was the United States itself, mm-hmm. they were set up to preserve certain things. And in this particular case, as somebody said, there's no oil in Bosnia. There's our national interest is not at stake. It is at stake if it spills out. But it seems to me that if you're looking at the youth, part of it is there, in going back to the just war, there may be a need to have a peacekeeper that is, has military force to stand up to this tyrants of the world that are abusing their population. And that's, we're trying to do that in World Court and in National Security Council, or the Security Council of the United Nations. But if we sit back and we bring our hands, and we know that if this gets out of hand, then we're right back into it again.
These issues, Bosnia is a particularly, I think, complex and difficult thing for peacemakers to look at and to deal with because of these conflicting poles that we have. And because it is complex and we don't always understand it. In the first session, I quoted Cicela Bock's introduction to her book on a strategy for peace, in which she presents Immanuel Kant's four basic requirements for peace. And I'll get them so that I can phrase them succinctly instead of... one is the renunciation of violence. A requirement for peace is no violence. Secondly, an insistence on truth. Third, a fidelity to commitment. And fourth, a limitation on secrecy. Now those, the second and the fourth, the insistence on truth and accuracy and the limitation on secrecy, both mean that we need to have information. We need to know the facts. We need to know the history. We need to know what's going on right now. And we need to know consequences of our actions. Not that we can always predict them absolutely, but we need to know the possibility of those. So all of that goes into, it seems to me, the complexity of that situation. And there is no simple answer to it, and there is perhaps no one right way that presents itself, and there may only be, as there are in so many things, and in fact maybe in the whole issue of peacemaking, simply a place where you can move in and start working on something, even though it may not be on what seems like a final solution. That's the best I can say about Bosnia, but if someone else would like to add something to that. About the best I can say about a lot of places in the world as well. Tomorrow we're going to focus on solidarity, in which we can focus on maybe more specifics of certain areas and certain ways in which this particular way of going in and doing some small thing will work, is what is all we can do and what we can do.
Yeah. I agree with the comment that economics and widespread poverty is really at the base of much of this, because much of the both personal and international and political posturing for power has to do with the access to wealth, to comfort, to leisure, and so forth. And we tend as human beings too often to want to have the power so that we can have what we want for life's comforts, and we're willing to let others go without so that we can have more. And economics, if somehow all of us in the world had the same economic opportunity or power, the need for violence, I think, would be diminished immensely.
Somebody quote that. I think if everyone in the world was at the same level as Italy and Spain in 1960, that everyone would be equal, that people in Nigeria would have enough, and that we would, in this country, would go down to that level. That there would actually be enough of those resources to share. But it would be hard to agree.
Yeah. Basically, we are willing to give up what we have.
I'm passing around a cartoon that is in the Lutheran Peace Fellowship notes that speaks to what David is saying in the cartoon like way. So economics are really important. And that we've talked about the spirit of violence, and we've touched on a number of kinds of violence. We've talked about the violence of, what do we call it? Of, well, it isn't even force. The violence of guns, the violence of, can anyone help me out? Well, let's say physical violence. And we've touched on that, whether it's within the family, that ranges from hitting somebody to the nuclear, you know, all the way to nuclear arms. And we've talked about psychological violence. Whoops. And now we've touched on economic violence.
At the root of a lot of these is the economic control issue, that a lot of the domination and ability to perpetuate family violence is often linked to the economic reality that families in.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the choices feel limited.
Dorothy Ness, who's taught family structure and a lot of the issues in families today, had to leave, I'm sorry to say, because she could probably also speak to the fact that that economic violence we tend to think of happens for those people who don't have enough, who have a hard struggle, and it certainly is easy to see that could happen, and the frustration of not being able to have enough food for your children. You work three jobs, two people work three jobs, two people work four jobs, and in our, you know, with minimum wage, you can't rent a house and buy the clothes and buy the food for your children. But there's a great deal of both of these at the very highest level of income as well. And that just would also point to the kinds of pressures and stresses that are taken on by that group. Excuse me.
Well, in terms of getting at the economic violence, I think you see that in the cities most of all, where those who have wealth have land, and they control the way that land is used. So you can't skateboard, or they put up regulations that mm-hmm. they don't, no children, no dogs, no pets. Mm-hmm. There aren't any places to really enjoy your environment. Every place you go, there's a wall or a barrier or something.
Okay.
And so a lot of the city violence is just simply the fact that they can't get away. They're forced, they're constrained. There's no barbed wire, but it might as well be in some cases.
Mm-hmm. We talk about glass ceilings. We might have invisible walls, invisible barbed wire, too.
Just don't cross mm-hmm. a certain street.
Right. And sometimes all you have to do is cross a certain street to get from one part to the other.
That's right.
So economic violence, in Bosnia we have what we might call political violence. And the politics there is very much all tied up with religion, so it becomes a religious violence, political religious violence as well.
Is there something inherently violent about Christianity?
Wonderful question. In what way?
Well, in that we are fundamentally a universalizing religion, so that our message to every other group is that you're doing it wrong and you better change or you're doomed forever. And if you won't listen to our reason, we'll assist you.
How many people want this around this?
Yeah.
Can you see okay, Dave?
Yeah.
Well, it's like the missionaries down in the rainforest in South America. The some very tribe that's not been around Western culture at all, and it's been kind of more like, more, so to speak, one of the last few unimpacted by our values. Missionaries use flashlights. As a, you know, they come to the little church and they give them flashlights, but flashlights need batteries, so this keeps them coming back. It's
can't, I can hear a number of sermons about this in my ears. I sometimes say I'm over church. I can hear. I mean, I've heard sermons about coming to church to get your batteries recharged, frankly. So, and they prob- and that might have exactly as negative an impact on spirituality as coming to get batteries to put in your little flashlights or radios, sometimes
and
radios.
The spirituality of these people had a wonderful, you know, natural quality to it. I felt awful to realize that this was being done in the name of Christianity.
Okay, which is why you would you agree with my quote? Are those quotes okay for you too? Is that the way you were saying it? Okay. Any other responses to this question?
One could even talk about the central feature of Christianity, which was the violence against Christ. You know, there was a terrible violence against him. And the doctrine says it was necessary.
It was necessary to have that violence.
He had to die. He was the sacrifice for our sins.
That would be in the same category as Milton's Paradise Lost, "O fortunate fall, how lucky we are that there was this fall so that we could then be in touch. We could struggle back towards God, and God could give us Christ, and in that Christ show us perfect love."
If you've traveled in Europe and you've done the cathedral bit, I mean, what's the, I don't know whether it's the most favorite, but I suddenly saw it everywhere, and that was St. Sebastian. Arrows stuck out all over him. Or the medieval images, lots of blood. The thorns are there. The gash is a gash. Mm-hmm.
The suffering.
That's almost the religious equivalent of gratuitous violence on TV.
So it's a kind of a twist in that way. I've come with quotes and with things I would like to share with you in many ways, and you would think with all of this I would have with me a poem that I discovered. It was written by one of the Spanish priests who was translating one of the Indian languages into the doctrine so that the Tarascan Indians in Mexico could be baptized, teaching them the doctrines. And he wrote a poem that basically says, "I don't love you out of fear of hell. I don't love you out of hope of heaven. If there were no hell, I would love you. If there were no heaven, I would love you. But it is the power of your love that compels me to love. It's seeing you on the cross, this violence you're talking about, seeing you betrayed, and the gift of that death that causes me to love you. Were there no heaven, I would love you still. Were there no hell, I would love you still." And I would, I regret very much that I simplified the number of things I took so that I couldn't quote it directly. But if you'd like to see that poem as it is translated in poetry, I'd be happy to show it to you. So
this is a great paradox of history, is that the, you know, the message of Jesus is basically a peace-filled message, and the way in which we have carried that message throughout the world has involved a lot of violence and still does today. And I don't know if that paradox has to be with us forever, but it certainly is.
Yeah. There's a book, the 100 most influential people in the world, and because of that, Christ is considered fourth.
Yeah, third actually.
Third.
But they said that his message was pretty radical, but nobody follows it, so it hasn't really had that much effect in the world.
Chesterton said, "It is not that Christianity has been tried and found to fail; it's that it's been tried and it has been found too difficult." So that's the challenge of it. I think we're going to have so many things going that we're not going to resolve anything, which is fine. And but I would like people to speak to the kinds of things that they might be still wondering about a little bit.
Yeah, I'm having a real issue in my own thinking. when one is confrontational, or perhaps that's the wrong thing to do, to be, but when one sees the truth and says it, oftentimes violence does come from that. And if that's one of Kant's ideas, that you should see the truth and you should speak the truth, then you often do set up confrontations, and I'm not sure how you resolve that, or how that can be resolved, speaking to your first question. Is there a conflict between peace and justice? I mean, I guess I see it inherent all the time.
I go back to it. Sometimes it's not, it's how we speak the truth. We go back to this language again. That doesn't mean there's not going to be, your point is a very significant one, that even though we speak and we choose language that is not violent, or that is a way of confronting, that speaks the message of love, it still causes fear sometimes, and fear, as you pointed out, gets violent responses. But for me, the challenge in that is to speak the truth. It's how we speak the truth.
And how we deal with the conflict.
And how we follow it.
I'm not remembering if what is under Tom Witt's picture is, it says anything about that. He's a person who's been very consciously and very articulately walking the way of peace for many years. And he says, he's a person who does not shy away from conflict. In fact, he says, sometimes my friends say that I will stir things up. But he doesn't think that a way of peace does not include conflict. But conflict for him means differences of opinion, different ways of looking at things. And the important thing is to work that out. Some people have used the metaphor of a wrestling match in which you struggle. It is, and of course, if you are into wrestling competitively, this is not going to work, I think, it's at all. But it's a way of putting together a strength from here and strength from there, and then seeing how that strength can, you know, how that strength comes around. So that I think as a peacemaker, one always has to realize this does not mean you're going to avoid conflict, and you're probably going to be right in the conflict, and maybe it is what you do when you are in the middle of it. I've been in situations where there's been terrible conflict, and a person can come in and not avoid it, but by the way in which that person responds, or the addition of ideas, or even just presence, even just the ears, makes a difference. And we do a lot with conflict resolution, and that usually involves a third person who is neutral and who sort of keeps sort of calling the plays or describing the plays rather than to give the solutions, as a way of helping people work towards something that does work. So that, it seems to me, is an important thing to remember on that.
I think there's always the risk of conflict in one's religious activities, especially Christianity, which is a subversive religion. You know, it sets out to subvert most of our human patterns and value systems. And we don't like to have our comforts and our values subverted. And most of us fight back when anyone is trying to overturn our way of living. And if we espouse a faith that is overturning somebody else's values, we're going to be risking conflict. And we have to figure out how to respond to that.
The people in the third, in what we call the third world, certainly people from, I've heard people from Africa, from Central America, from East Germany say, but particularly the people who've come from Central America, they come up here, they say, you give us a lot. You give us a lot from North America, through the church, in other ways, but we've got something to give you too. And what we have to give you is an understanding of what it means to be a, not what Christianity means, what it means to be a follower of Christ. And they would say, there's not something inherently violent in being a follower of Christ, but there is conflict. within yourself, between your, within your family sometimes, in your situation. And so they say, what we have, we are, you have given us the message, you've given us the gospel, you've brought it to Central America, South America, to Africa. You've planted the seed and it's bearing fruit, and now we are bringing it back to you. And it's an important thing to realize, and it, I think, enriches us to on every level, but even just on, I teach international students, and I know it enriches you on any level, from just the fact of meeting someone who is different, to understanding that person's values, to understanding that person's commitment, and to understand what can change your own life by knowing those things. So that there is a gift that is returning to in this way. Are we supposed to close at 11:30?
Yeah.
Excuse me, I interrupted you. Go, keep going.
Oh, all right. We have about 5 minutes to wrap up this session on reducing violence. Would you like to move to some just general ideas as to ways in which one can work on reducing violence?
Yes, sir.
All right.
It seems to me that people have to listen to each other better.
Okay.
And that the trouble in many of those spheres is that there's a conflict and people's positions harden, or people are angry, or people feel they haven't, that they equate justice with fairness, and that's all they can listen to. They're not willing to hear and then try to understand.
All right.
I think we need to give people a stake in their own lives and in what's going on around them. So that they can, at least they have something. And maybe we shouldn't give it to them. It should be revealed to them, if you will, that that they have a stake. We can't give anything. We let them know that they have the opportunity to share, to take a stand.
In a sense, is it allow people to have their rightful stake.
There you go. I like that better.
Who knows a word that is used a lot to say this, and maybe to
empowerment. You can't empower anyone, but you can think. You really can't.
Only they can become person.
They can become empowered. So part of the delicacy is this: if you think you're trying to, that you're empowering somebody, mm-hmm. you may actually be controlling. But show openness to and allow maybe what your gift might be true is to opportunities for them to see other choices.
Okay.
But truly, they have to make, each person has to make their own choice.
You say don't write down empowerment.
Well,
that is the word that's used, and you're so right that we need to look at these words and understand what they mean. People who say empowerment might mean this, and you can empower someone by if you in a way maybe you can't, but I'm going to throw this out first. Can you empower someone by saying you can do it? You can do it. You can whatever it is. You can cross that stream. You can.
That's supporting.
It's supporting, but it has in some way given them power to do.
Well, I guess you can empower, maybe a way to do it, to say that is to say,
this way to empower somebody is to educate them. Mm-hmm. Education is at the bottom of their mind.
So that they discover that they can drown it.
Right. Well, okay. In the sense of drawing out what they have, when we teach writing, it's saying you have something to say. What do you have to say?
Right.
You draw that out rather than telling them write it this way, or build your society this way. But to allow them to be empowered, I think maybe would be the way to say it.
Okay, so here we're back to our definition: continue to define, continue to challenge terms, and to know it. Okay, so we can do this by listening. by allowing people to have their rightful stake, whether that means, and that might mean showing them what their rightful stakes are. My daughter's in El Salvador now with the UN Mission on Human Rights, and one of her tasks has been to go to the villages and to show them, to tell them what the UN Declaration of Human Rights is all about, what that means for them in their communities, right there, and what that means for them in their country. Because that country is a country that's being born. They're really trying to remake something that's a very delicate and very fragile thing right now. And it's by no means going perfectly. But in that struggle that is continuing, education is playing an important, very important role.
What about giving people money? It's someone who has a talent, a gift, an idea, a plan, but no money.
So that's economic justice in a sense as well.
Right. I often think of people who are ready to do something and have the power in a sense to do it, the abilities in the people, but everything but the money to get it started.
Right. We had in our community a study on poverty, and we were trying to change the social system of whether or not the aid was going to be given by the sheriff or from the county welfare department. And there was a big struggle there about that. And we were studying all kinds of economic issues within the area. And they said, well, the difference is between the poor and the non-poor. You're all upset about the poor. The difference is money. Give them money, then they won't be poor. And it was a wonderful solution, but nobody, it's also a very difficult one. But I think it's right. And that also comes from, if everyone has their fair share, then that'll help.
But you can also, with that, if you give money, if you do this kind of candy, like if you give someone a fish, it doesn't help them to learn how to fish. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, can be some of the disservices that with our high technology, if we go into areas where a community does not have that kind of skills and backgrounds, that's almost another abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And another way for a Western perspective to say, oh, well, see, we tried and it didn't work.
So we mentioned education, and that's really important. Education is money, whether it is tuition for college or whether it is the kind of support system in your local public school through your taxes that pays for the kind of support that the children in that community need, or for the books for everybody, or whatever it is. So that's a very important thing. Anyone else want to? Yes?
Well, on a personal level, it's related to listening. How do I practice nonviolence? I would put patience down.
Yes. Patience with the person you're dealing with and with the solution to the problem. It takes time. It is not easy. And it doesn't happen fast. Our hour is basically up, and it's been a very rich hour. And I haven't gotten to any of the things I wrote down. But and we focused on some really, really important things, I think. We've talked about reducing violence in ways that are important to those, all of us in the room, and I think that's really important as well. Just quickly, I'll read through some of the things that John Stoner mentions, which can maybe expand the kinds of things you think about in reducing violence or ways you can reduce violence to take with you and to think about some more. And this will reemphasize what I feel is the action, the positive force towards making peace. The first of all, it says, practice nonviolent...